You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. I'm Daryl West, Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. And I would like to welcome you to our 9th annual John Hazen White Manufacturing Forum. And this forum is supported by John Hazen White, who also is a Brookings trustee. John and his wife Liz and sons John and Ben have been longtime supporters. So I want to thank them for the financial gifts that they have provided. And that enables the independent work that our scholars do. So one of the big issues over the past few months has been the COVID pandemic. It has ravaged people's health and created serious economic issues for the country as well as the world. The manufacturing sector has been hit hard by questions in terms of consumer demand, supply chain issues, and business practices. So today we want to look at how these challenges have been handled and what is the future trajectory of the sector. To help us with these issues, we put together a distinguished set of experts with considerable knowledge about manufacturing. John White is the Senior Vice President of OEM Sales at Taco Comfort Solutions, and he focuses on sales and customer relations. Ben White is Vice President of Corporate Development at Taco Comfort Solutions, and he deals with issues related to company operations. David Cicilline is a congressman from Rhode Island. He was elected in 2006 and has risen to a leadership position within the House of Representatives. He serves as chair of the Democratic Policy and Communications Committee and also chairs the House Antitrust Subcommittee. And he's been a leading advocate for the Make It in America agenda for strengthening U.S. manufacturing. Susan Helper is a Carleton Professor of Economics at Case Western University. She writes extensively about manufacturing and how it deals with various challenges. And for those of you who are watching, I would encourage you to submit questions. We will save time in this forum to incorporate your questions into our discussion. You can do that via Twitter. We set up a hashtag called USMFG, USMFG, so you can submit questions and we will get to as many of them as possible. So I want to start with John. So COVID has had a dramatic impact on the economy and business operations. And in the initial phase of the pandemic, how did your company respond? I know you mainly work on the sales side. What problems or challenges did you encounter and how did you overcome them?
Hi, Daryl. Good morning, everybody. So actually, Daryl, for these couple questions, I think my brother and I are going to sort of tag team them because we both are on very different sides of the business and we both bring different perspectives. And I think in true big brother fashion, I'm actually going to kick this one to Ben first so we can discuss the operational side of it. And then I can kind of tie that into how the sales aspect worked as well. So,
okay. Sounds good. So Ben, why don't you jump in?
Good morning, everybody. It's great to be here with you all and an honor to be on this panel. When COVID hit back in late February, early March, we started to see things. It definitely changed the way that we looked at our business overnight. We had a team of our executive leadership team globally that began meeting every morning at 7:30, kind of reviewing what happened the day before, what are we going to be doing today and moving forward. And so the way that we operate, we had to really shift quickly. And that included everything from shifting to a work from home schedule for all of our office workers or anybody that could work from home. And it changed the way that we laid out our factory. So we really had to look at our operations and figure out ways that we could change our setup to allow for social distancing. We had a team that worked diligently to install plexiglass dividers in between our employees on the manufacturing floor. And really, at the core of all of this was two main goals. One was the safety and health and well-being of our employees. And the second really being making sure that we were maintaining a healthy level of business continuity. So as we worked through this challenge, we wanted to make sure that when we come out on the other end of this, you know, we have a thriving business that can continue to move forward. So with that, you know, we really, we worked to make sure that we were procuring the right personal protective equipment, masks and sanitizers for our employees. And it really, we had to look at all the aspects of our business, changing visitor policies. So making sure that, you know, it wasn't people coming in off the street for meetings and things like that. We, as I said, work from home started kind of at the end of March. And that kind of shifted globally. And I think one of the biggest things for us was the communication amongst our global teams and making sure that we were all on the same page and how we address this. So our teams in Italy, in Switzerland, Czech Republic, Vietnam, we were all coordinated in how we address this and making sure that our communication out to the employees was transparent and making sure that they had all the questions answered that they had and making sure that they felt safe. So it's definitely changed the way that we operate on a daily basis. And I think will continue to be a lens that we look through in terms of planning new products in the future and the layout of our floor and of our offices and all those types of things. And I think, you know, as my brother John said, he can maybe touch on how it affected kind of the external side of the business and how we address things.
Okay, John, you want to jump in on the sales side and kind of the impact on customer relations?
Certainly. So on the sales side, you know, our immediate concern once we realized that, you know, this was a real thing and it was going to potentially and most certainly become more of a problem, more and more of an issue, our first priority was to make sure that on the sales side, we had product in the pipeline to supply the market. Because very, very quickly when this issue became up, you know, both Taco and also a lot of our customers, both on the, you know, in the trade, and so as far as plumbers, contractors, things like that, and also OEM customers, other manufacturers in the heating and cooling industry, were deemed essential manufacturers, which means that they were able to remain open. So very quickly we realized we have to make sure there's product out there in the pipeline to supply these people. They are essential, and without product, they can't do the job, which is essential. So within the first, I would say, week, our first priority was to contact all of our customers. I'll point out that Taco has two kind of main methods of distribution, if you will. I guess you could say our primary one is through buy-sell reps all over the country. These reps buy product from Taco. They stock it on the shelves so they can supply their local markets very quickly. We have reps in every single state. And the other method of distribution is through what we call OEM customers. OEM customers are other manufacturers in our industry that buy Taco products and then incorporate them into their finished goods. So, for example, you might buy a boiler, and that boiler will have a Taco pump on it. So, all these customers were deemed essential, and so we did a pretty much a full audit of our warehouse to look at all open orders for all of our customers and see what we already had built at that time on the shelf, ready to go. Didn't matter if it was supposed to ship in a week or in a month. We did a full audit of what we had on the shelf, and then began going through our customer list one by one, contacting our customers, and basically just saying, "Hey, look, you know what's going on here." There's a lot of uncertainty right now regarding, you know, manufacturing, regarding, you know, the ability to ship product, things like that. So here's what we have for you. Some of it's early. You know, will you take it? Would you like to have it so you have it on your shelf and so there's no risk to you? And I would say, especially on the OEM side, the response was overwhelmingly positive. Actually, other manufacturers came to us and said, "Thank you very much for taking the initiative, for offering. It's a true sign of partnership." I think only in maybe one or two cases, people said, "No, we're going to gamble and keep it there at Taco." So probably within the first three weeks of the pandemic becoming full blown, we had probably shipped about $500,000 worth of product on the OEM side early to make sure that our customers had the things on the shelf they needed to continue supplying essential products. So that was our primary concern, was to keep product in the pipeline. I think the other concern was more of a longer term concern, but we began to think about it then, which is that, you know, now that we had begun to figure out ways to keep manufacturing in a safe and healthy way and protect our employees, you know, understanding that we wouldn't be manufacturing in what was reduced capacity. The other challenge was to begin to look at the open orders going forward and figuring out prioritization. So if we only, you know, manufacture, let's say, at, you know, 50% capacity, what do we make? What do we push out? So that challenge just involved a lot of communication, you know, daily or weekly phone calls with all of our major customers, especially making sure that, you know, they knew, you know, what our capacities were, and they could tell us, you know, what is priority, what is not. That was a challenge. It became almost a full-time job. But I think we were able to handle it very, very well. And I have to give a major shout out to our supply chain and to our operations folks, buyer planners. Everybody worked together in a really, really wonderful way. I wouldn't call it seamless because there's a lot of challenges, But I think our customers appreciated how we handled it, and I think it was done the best way possible.
Hey, it's great to have the on-the-street perspective in terms of what you actually dealt with and how you responded. So I want to bring Congressman Cicilline into the conversation. So I know you've had a longstanding interest in manufacturing and have introduced legislation to promote it. So in terms of the COVID pandemic, what were your worries about manufacturing, and what do you think the government should be doing to help out in this area?
Well, thank you again for having me on this panel, and it's great to be with the next generation of manufacturers, young Ben and John. And it's, I think, a sign that manufacturing is alive and well in America. So I think one of the things that concerned me at the very outset of the outbreak of the pandemic was real concern about the supply chain and whether or not we would have access to the equipment, the critical equipment, ventilators and PPE and testing materials. And I think one of the things that was revealed during that early days of the pandemic was it was sort of a reminder to the American people why it matters that we have a strong manufacturing ecosystem, particularly in the midst of a global health pandemic. And in particular, I was concerned that the president didn't invoke the Defense Production Act, which was really a powerful tool to ensure that manufacturers were producing the things we needed to respond to this crisis in a very direct way. And there was not federal coordination of the manufacturing of those materials and then the distribution. So we basically had every governor, every mayor kind of in a fight, you know, competing for these critical life-saving materials, driving up the cost and the kind of irrational distribution, not based on where there was an outbreak or there was need, but just based on who had the best contacts, who made the phone calls first. That, it seemed to me, revealed a total breakdown of what should have been an organized, rational distribution of critical goods being manufactured here in the United States. In response to that, I actually introduced a piece of legislation called the Global Pandemic Planning Act that would require the president to report to Congress on the status of planning and logistics for the delivery of critical supplies during a global health pandemic, and to describe whether he or she has invoked the Defense Production Act and how and why. So I think that's an immediate tool that was really not properly used by the administration. But the impact of manufacturing, as Ben and John said, is significant in large part because manufacturing very often is, you know, people working in close proximity to each other, touching lots of products. And so it has all the conditions that would make the transmission of a highly contagious virus particularly dangerous. And so one of the things that I think we have to do, and I've been advocating for, is to urge in the next piece of legislation that we do, that we waive the cost share of the Manufacturing Extension Partnership Program, which is a really effective program to support small and medium-sized manufacturers, and to also double the funding for that program. So get rid of the cost share, double the funding so we can really supercharge American manufacturing. And then the other thing I think we have to do, and I'm pleased the Vice President is announcing his manufacturing plan, which includes something I've worked on for a long time in Congress, and that is to really modernize the Buy America provisions and close the loopholes so that we're using the purchasing power of the federal government to actually support American manufacturers. Even in this pandemic, the stories I've heard from local manufacturers where we're buying supplies like masks and protective equipment overseas when manufacturers have had to stop manufacturing their own line of goods and could be manufacturing and are manufacturing critical medical supplies and we're not buying it from them. It's just crazy. So, you know, modernizing and updating the Buy America provisions to really support American manufacturing is the other thing I think we have to do.
Okay. Susan, so you're an economist at Case Western Reserve University, and you've written extensively on manufacturing issues, and I know you pay a lot of attention to the supply side issues that the congressman just mentioned. So what do you see as the critical problems, and how can we address them?
Wow, it's a big question, and I think it's a really exciting time for manufacturing. I think the the contributions of people like Teco Comfort Solutions are now being recognized, I think, in a way that they weren't in America. We've kind of seen the dangers of having, for example, 80% of our pharmaceutical active ingredients made abroad, our masks and other forms of PPE made abroad. And it's not to say that, everything needs to be made in the U.S., but I think what's happened is we've gotten an imbalance that led to some of the problems that we've seen. And so I think we need to sort of think about, building it back better, I guess is the new slogan. So not just getting through this current program, but can we, when we spend money to revive the economy, can we do it in a way that actually creates a new infrastructure and helps us deal with future pandemics that I think, it's just a question of if, not when. And so I guess I've sort of seen kind of three things that we need to do. We need to sort of, rebuild supply. And I think some of the stuff that the congressman mentioned and we'll talk about in the Biden plan begin to do that. That there's a lot of market failures that mean that we don't have a lot of manufacturing supply and capability in the U.S. A second issue that sometimes has been overlooked is demand. You can build up, you can subsidize people to do things, but now you need to make sure that there's a stable demand for those products. Demand for masks is up tenfold. What happens when that demand falls? And so I think some of this Buy America stuff is actually quite interesting and important in making sure that companies that do build up capabilities actually have a long-term ability to make a return on that investment. And then third is doing things that make sure that taxpayer money is used wisely. And I think we've seen, to the congressman's interest in antitrust, that some of the efforts, actually there was an effort to have a cheap, robust ventilator supply, and a small company was interested in doing it, Newport Medical Systems. They then got bought by a large company that was not interested in having a competitor to their product. So I think thinking about these kinds of things, of demand, supply, and some conditions on support to make sure it's used, that those would be at least the elements of a plan. And I think we're starting to see what that, the details get filled in.
Okay, terrific. So Ben and John, I want to come back to you. So going forward, what challenges do you see and how has the pandemic affected manufacturing in terms of both sales and operations? What are the changes that you've seen so far do you think are temporary changes and which ones do you think are permanently going to alter the sector itself?
Great question, Darrell. I think, looking forward, one of the things that we did early on was we split our entire workforce into two groups basically worked on a 1 week on, 1 week off, so that we had the ability to minimize the exposure of employees to each other. And that was really when things were picking up. That gave us the ability also to, as we reassessed our manufacturing layout, it gave us the ability to do things like put in the partitions and plexiglass, reevaluate our shop floor layout so that we could adhere to social distancing guidelines. I think moving forward, that will always be something that we think about when we're looking at, if we're looking at a new product and what does that manufacturing cell look like. I think these types of measures will be a lens we need to look through. Moving forward, and it certainly it drives again towards that goal of our number one goals is having a healthy and safe workforce. So I think that will always be something that we now take into consideration. Looking, I think as we discussed a little bit earlier as well, the supply chain side of things, really kind of rethinking things like inventory levels, leveraging our relationship with our suppliers and our backup suppliers, and leaning on things like our long-lasting relationships with our core supply base. Excuse me. I think these are all things that up until this point were things we worked on, but this really puts a magnifying glass on it, makes us evaluate it, and I think it will change the way in which we approach situations like this moving forward. And John can maybe touch a little bit more on the sales side of things. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as far as sales is concerned, you know, there have been some major shifts in how we do business. I think it's made us think about maybe how we'll do business going forward. I think probably the largest one, you know, coming from a sales perspective, is travel. The idea of travel and being present with a customer. You know, anybody who's done sales in any capacity will tell you, you know, the most important thing you can do is be in front of a customer to build that relationship, whether it's, you know, over a cup of coffee, over dinner, or just to have them have a face-to-face relationship so that, you know, when or if something does go wrong, you have that rapport. It's not just, I'm your supplier, you're my customer, you know, boom, here you go. I think for us, what we found very quickly is, you know, in the very early stages of this, Takeo was very aggressive with our travel policy. You know, first of all, with international travel, and then with air travel, and then pretty much with all travel, which was absolutely the smart thing to do. And the other piece of that is that, you know, your travel policy can be whatever you want it to be. If nobody wants to see you, if nobody wants to have you in their facility, then it doesn't really matter. So I think it's really changed the way that on the sales side that we service our customers. I think we've made a really great use of Microsoft Teams. And coming into this whole pandemic, we had begun to incorporate Microsoft Teams for Takeo, for use at Takeo. So this kind of just forced that on a fast track. So I think it's going to change the way we think about travel and personal visitations going forward. I think, and I hope, to be quite frank, that they don't go away entirely, because there is so much value to being at a customer also, and to see their manufacturing process and understand what their needs are. But you know, the amount of interaction we can have over these video meetings has been really, really significant. And I think in some ways, actually, we're actually in touch with our customers more now than we were before, because, you know, number one, we're in touch quite regularly just to see what their status of business is. You know, have things been affected? Are you actually open? Things like that. But also just, it's so easy to just hit the video call button and take 10 minutes and have a face-to-face. So I think, you know, maybe going forward, you know, maybe a customer where you typically would go see them 4 or 5 times a year, maybe you see them 2 times a year, but you make more use of this technology. I think that's probably a change that has happened and will probably manifest itself permanently going forward to some degree. I think the other thing that we've seen from the very early stages here was an increased focus on forecasting and really understanding, you know, what customers need, you know, what their needs are and what our capabilities are. Because when everything's running 100% perfectly, it's no problem. You can you know, adjust things very easily, maybe slip another order in, you know, no problem. When you all of a sudden have either reduced manufacturing capacity challenges, you have to be very selective, and you have to really know what you need and what needs to be made. And I think, you know, the sales team has been very, very aggressive about forecasting and working with their customers. And I think, you know, and going back to what Ben said about, you know, maybe rethinking inventory levels, things like that, I think the importance of forecasting and just increased communication with the customer regarding their needs is going to be very, very important. I think that will not change.
So, Congressman, earlier you mentioned some of the things that you would like to see the federal government undertake, but it also seems like the states are starting to get organized. We're starting to see regional partnerships. States are starting to coordinate various types of supply chain issues, procurement practices, and so on. Are there economies of scale among American states where you think cooperation and coordination would end up helping everybody?
Absolutely. You know, I think that we know actually from a lot of good work that Brookings has done that our economies don't stop at the state lines and that they actually operate regionally. And so I think, you know, there are a number of programs, both the Manufacturing Extension Partnership and Manufacturing USA, which are really effective and good programs. And we ought to be thinking about allowing those to be executed regionally. One of the things that I've done is I've introduced a piece of legislation to create the Southeastern New England Regional Commission, which will take in kind of the economies of Southeastern Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and a little bit of Connecticut, where there's a lot of common manufacturing opportunities and clusters, and be able to do some planning and some strategic investment from the federal government to support manufacturing in that region. So that's a hard thing to do sometimes politically, because we measure success in terms of jobs created, in terms of economic growth within state borders or city borders. And we have to sort of think about this work regionally. And I think these kinds of regional commissions is one way to do it. And, you know, I think it's something that we really have to create a template for really smart investments in kind of regional planning. But I think states are recognizing the commonality of their regional economies. And, you know, we benefit from the maritime industry in southeastern Massachusetts as they do from maritime industry and defense industries in Rhode Island. And so, you know, I think the federal government has to facilitate that kind of thinking and planning and investment in the way we fund investments in manufacturing as well.
Well, thanks for the shout out of the Brookings work. I want to acknowledge the great work our Metro colleagues have done at the state and local level in trying to promote manufacturing. So, Susan, you have mentioned a number of different ideas in your writing, just in terms of the need to change purchasing policies, looking at local content requirements. You mentioned the possibility of the U.S. developing a national investment bank. Could you talk a little bit about these ideas and why you think they might be helpful? And if you could unmute yourself.
Yeah, we've developed, I think, just over the last 20 years, a manufacturing system that was sort of developed on, you know, innovate here, produce there. And I think one of the things we're seeing at the variety of reasons that doesn't work. You don't no longer get ideas that you need to innovate if you're not producing. And you also lack access to materials in a pandemic, as we're seeing right now. And so you know, sort of ask, well, why, what kinds of things make it hard for small business to do things like adopt Industry 4.0, which is a really cool way of bringing information to bear on manufacturing and automate and get real-time information. And a lot of it is we have a purchasing system that's set up to really minimize unit costs and not think about long-term capability. And I think this is an issue both in government and long-term in private business. And so I think some of these Buy America and domestic content rules will be important. But I also think that really thinking through, you know, what value does a product add? You know, maybe the piece price, the unit cost is a little bit higher, but maybe it comes with, you know, the excellent customer service that Taco provides, that, and that can be documented and quantified. And so I think thinking about that kind of thing is really important. And I think then getting, we've mentioned the Manufacturing Extension Partnership. And one of the things I think is very important about that program, tiny as it is that it helps companies put together the pieces of a new and more innovative manufacturing system. It's not just, you know, worker training. It's not just new equipment. It's those two things together plus new ways of managing, you know, including things like taking advantage of worker knowledge on the shop floor to, you know, where do the sensors go? What can be automated? How do you automate it? And the MEP has done some of this work. I'd like to see them stood up to do a bit more of this work and to then coordinate nationally and regionally supply chains. So that's a little on the purchasing. And to think about the finance side, one of the things I think that we've struggled with, you know, small business has struggled with, they don't necessarily want to invest because they don't know, they have such fierce competition. They get one chance. You make a mistake and you guess on the wrong material, you guess on the wrong piece of new equipment, you're out of business. And so it's easier to just let your equipment depreciate, try to squeeze your workers a little harder. That's not a recipe for long-term success. And so thinking about, you know, how do you get capital to these firms in a way that isn't so expensive? And how do you get venture capital and or new firms, new ideas? How do you help them get started? And it may be that we actually need to think about some government provision, not just of the money, but also of the expertise and the criteria for lending. So some really interesting ideas about a national investment bank that I think should be explored further.
Okay, so we are in the middle of a presidential campaign, and actually just today, candidate Joe Biden released his plan to promote manufacturing. So I'd like to throw out a question and get each of your thoughts on this. So first, on the Biden side, his plan proposes to spend $700 billion on American products and research. This would include $400 billion for a procurement initiative to encourage federal agencies to buy American products, and then another $300 billion to support research and development. Among the particular provisions would be money for clean energy, a supply chain review that would ask agencies to buy essential supplies from U.S. Manufacturers. And he also wants to close some of the loopholes on Buy America requirements. President Trump also has talked a lot about manufacturing during his term of office. He's issued executive orders, for example, requiring essential medical supplies to be purchased from American manufacturers. He's cut taxes. He's pushed various types of deregulation. So I'd like to get the thoughts of from each of you just on each of those perspectives, what you would like to see happen, kind of what are the strengths and or disadvantages of each of the approaches that we're seeing. Maybe Ben, we can start with you.
Yeah, so I unfortunately I haven't had a chance to review the bill just put, or the plan that was just put out this morning, but I think, I mean, all of these initiatives are important, right? I think as we look at clean energy supply chain reviews, kind of maybe some loosening on the Buy America requirements, these things are all, I think, if done correctly, things that can help American manufacturers and American manufacturers globally be successful. And we need to constantly be looking at these and you know, I'm not an expert in any particular one of those areas, but working with our teams to really understand how do these affect us? How can we work them to our advantage and work them in relationships with our supply chain team, with our suppliers, our customers, and making sure that we have a sustainable business model that will help us carry this forward for another 100 years. So I think in conjunction with each other, they can be, if utilized correctly, helpful to our business model.
Okay, John, your thoughts on these plans?
It's a big question, Daryl. I think... And without going too deep in the weeds on either one, because you know, unfortunately, I've not had a chance to review in depth the most recent proposal. But what I would say and what I would like to see in general is, you know, if we're going to pour a ton of money into American manufacturing and to protect it and to grow it, I think there's a lot of good to that. And if we're going to be adjusting policies, either you know domestically or how we interact with other countries as well to protect and grow American manufacturing, I think it's a good thing. And obviously, you know, manufacturing to everybody in this panel and to our family especially is very, very near and dear to our hearts. I think the one thing I'd like to see, no matter which direction we go and no matter what happens in November going forward, I just would hope that the people who are putting these policies into place and the people that are ultimately going to control where this money goes or where resources go have the ability and have the willingness to work with American manufacturers. And so if policies are created or if we're going to be allocating resources, let's do that with the input of American manufacturers to make sure it's going to the right places, to make sure it's going where it's really, really needed. And so that would be my, you know, sort of very high level answer to that is I think wherever we end up going, I'd like to go there with a lot of input from the manufacturers who need the help and who also can give you the best direction or at least the best, you know, experience. I mean, to pull back to a very, very low level at TACO, we've always found that when we're you know, going to be changing manufacturing process, changing a policy, changing you know, how we do things, the first people we go to, particularly in the factory, are the people on the line who do the job every single day, who build that part, because they know more about that than you know we'll ever, you know, they'll forget more about it than we'll ever know. So I just hope that they bring in our experiences and our direct needs. So hope that was okay.
Yes. No, thanks for that answer. Congressman Cicilline, your thoughts on the Biden plan and either comparisons and or contrast with the Trump approach?
Well, I mean, I think the Trump administration has, like so many areas, talked a good game, but the conduct of the administration has actually significantly undermined American manufacturing. And so it began with the president's tariff war with the Chinese, which seemed very sort of not strategic. And I know I heard from lots of manufacturers in Rhode Island who were significantly impacted by the imposition of tariffs. The Chinese seemed to have been in a better position to weather them. So I think having good trade policy that actually promotes American manufacturers and American business and American workers is key. I think the other thing is the president supported and the Republicans passed a tax bill at the beginning of last year that incentivized offshoring of manufacturing jobs. It provided benefits and lower tax rates to corporate, to economic activity outside of the United States. So I think a serious revision of our tax code. So we're actually incentivizing jobs being created in America, which, by the way, is a bill I've introduced in the House and the Senate, or White House is introduced in the Senate, just the opposite of what the tax bill does, and said if we're going to give a tax incentive, it ought to be to create jobs in America, not to create them outside of the United States. And I think that the investment in the area, the clusters that the Vice President Biden has named in his plans are important and emerging important sectors of our economy. And then finally, I think this notion of something I've worked on with Senator Murphy for the last couple of years is really modernizing our Buy America provisions. So, you know, it's the case that virtually every agency of the federal government has figured out a way to work around these provisions for some exemption. And so they're using taxpayer money to buy goods and services manufactured outside of the United States. That's lunacy. We ought to be using taxpayer money to support American jobs, American business, and American manufacturers. So I think those are four areas that I know Vice President Biden is likely to do. I think President Trump's policy in terms of supporting American manufacturing has been a disaster.
Hey, Susan, your thoughts on the Biden plan and the things Trump has proposed?
Yeah, I guess just to pick up on the tariffs, I guess unlike probably most economists, I'm not always opposed to tariffs, but I think the way they were implemented was really, you know, sudden, haphazard, and didn't really take into account how modern supply chains are organized, where a lot of American manufacturers really depend on inputs from China. And you know, there's some issues with that going forward long term, that a lot of the reason these prices are cheap is that China is subsidizing things, they're exploiting their workers, exploiting the environment, but you don't change that overnight by just tripling the price. And so one of the things I think is interesting about the Biden plan is an effort to kind of coordinate and complement that, you know, when you're trying to redo a whole system, you need to think about, you know, these different sides, the supply side, the demand side. So I think, you know, at least the broad outlines of the plan, you know, there's a demand side plan piece from the government, this government procurement, and then there's a supply side piece. Let's build innovation. This is the long-term place where the U.S. needs to compete is innovation, not just in products, but also in process. So I think that there's a promise there that of kind of coordinated thought through policy that we haven't seen from the Trump administration.
Okay, we're starting to get questions from the audience, so I'd like to get your thoughts on some of those items. So we have a question from a law professor who lives in Egypt, El-Siad Abdul Khalid, and he wants to know, what can manufacturers do to protect worker health at a time of COVID? Ben, you want to start with?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great question. And I think at the forefront of that is something that we've tried to be very intentional about through this whole experience, which is communication and being transparent. I think making sure that all of our employees are aware of what's going on daily, making sure they're getting regular updates, and that we are upfront and clear with everybody about the measures that we're taking, the changes that we're making, whether it be from a policy standpoint internally or like we were talking about earlier, the shop floor layout. I think making sure that our employees, that employees at any business are communicated to on a regular basis, that they understand what's going on, that they have the ability to ask questions and express their concerns. Because a lot of times, as we found as we went through this, concerns may lead to things that we hadn't thought of, that we can, where we can make improvements. And like I said at the very beginning of this, I think the number one goal, and many employers would probably say this, is to have employees who feel safe, who are healthy, and that come to work every day in a place where the employer can support that type of environment. So as we've gone through all of this, I think just the number one thing is clear communication. And I think sometimes, you know, when we first started addressing some of the things that were coming to light with COVID. We jumped on things in ways that maybe some people would say were being, overreacting. But as we moved through, and John, mentioned earlier some of the travel restrictions we put in place and things like that, I'd rather overreact now and protect our employees and see what happens as we go forward than have to deal with something further down the line because we didn't take something seriously. So I think really being aware of what's going on globally and how we can implement these measures internally. But that line of communication, I think, is really and transparency is really crucial.
John, your thoughts on how to protect workers. And I might also note you have factories both in Italy and Vietnam. So I would also be interested in that international angle.
Absolutely. Well, I think as far as how to protect the health of workers and moving forward, I think, I think most companies from the last several months have put into place, several policies and several, adjustments to how they do things in order to, at the very least, protect their employees up to that point. And whether that's doing A and B groups, whether that's putting up plexiglass shields between manufacturing stations, rotating people in and out of the office, things like that. I think what we can do to protect employee health going forward, first of all, would be to remain tenacious in how we pursue these policies and keep them in place. I think there's kind of a tendency at this point, I think everybody's hitting a point of burnout almost. It's been, 5-6 months since this all kind of began, and it's been a very stressful time. And all day on the news, it's COVID. And then you see a weekend like last weekend where you see pictures of the 4th of July in different places around the country where people are packed together like sardines, not wearing masks. People are sort of, I don't want to say over it, it's the wrong word, but I think the tendency to say, okay, it's been going on this long, what can you do? I think the most important thing is to remain tenacious in these policies, be that, continuing to restrict travel, continuing to maintain social distancing within the manufacturing environment if possible. So I would say ultimately stick with it would be the biggest thing. Don't let yourself get sloppy and slip because people are tired of wearing masks or tired of having to put on gloves, things like that. Stick with it would be my primary advice on that one.
And
Congressman, your views on how to protect worker health in the manufacturing area?
Well, I think first and foremost is to follow the guidance of public health experts. I think, we have agencies charged with that responsibility, particularly the CDC. I think this is a moment to reinforce that we need to follow the science and follow the medical experts on what are the appropriate distances and what are the appropriate protections. We included in the HEROES Act a provision that would require OSHA to require that businesses develop a plan specific to their business to keep their employees safe, applying the standards, the public health standards. I think just requiring businesses to think intentionally about the application of these safety standards. I mean, Takeo is a great example. They did that, of course, on their own, but there are businesses who are not doing that. So I think just following the science, following the public health directives, and being sure, the government, I think, has to play a role in helping businesses and schools and other critical places do the things that are necessary to make their facilities safe. This is not cheap. When you have to cut down the class size to 25% of the students in the class so they can be safely distant and make sure everyone has a mask, or if you have to install plexiglass and all kinds of things at a business, those cost money. And so making sure that we have resources available, either grants or loans at zero interest to or direct assistance to public institutions to help them do what we know is necessary to keep their employees safe is critical, because my experience is that most businesses want to do the right thing. They care about their employees, but the economics of it, and particularly in a severe economic downturn, are challenging, and we, the federal government, I think, has to be prepared to play a role to provide those resources.
Susan, your thoughts on what we need to do to protect worker health?
Yeah, one thing I might add, an idea is that they require companies at least of a certain size to at least think about having elected worker health and safety committees. This is a way of getting in an organized way some worker voice about ideas of you know, things you hadn't thought of, unsafe conditions, or sometimes there's conflicting incentives where the owners of the business want safe practices, but they haven't realized they've created some production pressure in a, you know, corner of the plant and people are being required to work too closely, but no individual really feels like they can speak up. So I think this kind of an organized body, and you could make it a condition, or you know, say in a few months or something, in order to get this money that the congressman is talking about to help with the health and safety, that you have to have some of these things. And maybe in a small company it doesn't make sense, but I think a bigger company it could really provide some really avenue for worker voice. It's useful just to both the companies and also to the workers.
Great idea.
We have another question from Eleanor Wolf of the Hewlett Heritage Society. She wants to know, how will the pandemic affect the move to a green economy in the manufacturing area?
I can jump in on that one a little bit.
Okay, Susan, go ahead.
I mean, I think this is a, you know, another example of a place where we have a chance to build things back better. In a couple ways. So one is, you know, there's a lot of, I think, chance to plan while people are at home. We can sort of think about what can we do differently. There is a direct correlation between air quality and the severity of the COVID experience for people. So I think it gives us, you know, short-term reasons why we want to clean up the air. And then I think, you know, as we think about a stimulus, how are we going to return, you know, and get people back to work? We have 11% unemployment now, generally, and 9% in manufacturing. I think there's an appetite to spend government money. And if we can spend it in a way that is also an investment in a green future, I think that would be a really great way of spending that money.
Yeah, if I could just jump in, I agree. And that's reflected in the infrastructure bill, which we just considered in the House, which has a major investment in renewable energies and resiliency. And it's reflected in Vice President Biden's manufacturing plan. So this is an opportunity to create good paying jobs in the green economy. At the same time, we're responding to the very serious national security threats of climate change, the very serious public health threats of climate change. And if there's one silver lining of COVID, I hope it's that people now have renewed our belief in science and the danger of not responding to real threats, whether they be a COVID, be a global health pandemic or climate. And I think there is growing awareness in this country that this is both a responsibility and an extraordinary opportunity to really build an economic recovery around a green economy and resilient and sustainable infrastructure and reducing carbon emissions and preserving our planet.
Okay, Lydia O'Neill, who's a reporter for Bloomberg Tax, wants to know, what are the biggest tax policy priorities in order to help manufacturing? Any of you who want to jump in?
You should probably ask the manufacturers. I mean, I have my own view of what I think would be useful from a legislative perspective, but Ben or John may have a better idea of what would be helpful to their own business.
I would say if you're going to start and lay out what your thoughts are, I'll hop in on the other side of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the investment tax credit is one that is always raised by manufacturers. But I think in terms of if we, you know, I mentioned it earlier in the panel, I think we have to totally reverse the existing tax structure. You know, manufacturers are like other businesses. They're designed to make a profit and to maximize profits. And so to the extent that we have a tax code that incentivizes them to offshore their economic activity and enjoy a lower tax rate, we have a tax code that's creating an incentive for creating good manufacturing jobs outside of the United States. So to me, this kind of most important thing we could do is reverse that immediately and create the same kind of incentive in our tax code to create good manufacturing jobs within the territorial borders of the United States. And then I think we have to I hear from manufacturers a lot about the necessity of training a skilled workforce, that they have jobs that are available, but they continue to have difficulty filling those jobs because folks don't have the skills. You know, manufacturing is changing quickly and people are willing to kind of improve their skills, but they need resources to do it. And so I think continuing to invest in really good job training and skill development so that folks can, you know, change their skill set as things change in manufacturing are two of the areas that I think are important priorities.
Susan, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I guess I definitely think we should reverse incentives for offshoring that are built into the tax code. But as far as other kinds of, you know, new tax breaks, I would rather take that dollar and use it to build government capability, because I think what we need is this coordinated change. I mean, the congressman mentioned the need for training. And so sometimes people say, oh, there should be a tax break for having apprentices. And I don't think that's well designed for the way costs really get incurred. When you set up an apprenticeship program, the costs are all up front. And you know, you have to get things certified, you have to design a program. And so a per employee tax break that then continues, you know, year after year, when you're not really incurring very many costs, it just is not well designed. And so I think it'd be better to take that money and use it to really provide companies assistance in those upfront costs. So let's, you know, have a government, either state or federal office, that really helps figure out what are these apprenticeable occupations, where are the courses. So I think thinking about government services rather than more tax breaks is a good direction to go.
Daryl, can I just add one thing to that? Because I think Susan, there's been a bill introduced for a number of years by my wonderful colleague Tim Ryan that calls for the development of a national manufacturing strategy. I'm proud to be a co-sponsor of that. I think that is something that, you know, Susan's comments would really benefit from. That is, you know, rather than sort of just reacting to an industry or an incident, actually develop a thoughtful, comprehensive national manufacturing strategy that says, if we're serious about, you know, growing American manufacturing, here are the ways we need to do it, both with our tax code, with the budget that we pass, with the way we think about workforce training, a fully integrated plan. And I hope when we have a Democratic majority in the House and the Senate and the Democratic president, that will become law. And then we can really have some, you know, not only someone leading this effort on behalf of our country, but actually a plan where there's real consensus that has been developed across the sectors that this is how we grow American manufacturing.
So John, your thoughts on tax policy priorities?
Yeah, I would say I would circle back to the congressman's first point, actually. And I think one priority would absolutely certainly be some sort of investment tax credit, because reinvesting into a business, particularly a manufacturing business, is incredibly important. We go up against competitors who are much, much larger than us. So we're constantly trying to figure out ways to optimize our manufacturing process, to potentially upgrade our technology, and keep ourselves, you know, very, very competitive. So the other piece of that actually ties back into what Congressman Cicilline was saying regarding, you know, investing in our workforce, because as we invest in machinery and processes and things like that, you need people to run those machines and know how to do these things. My dad has said it on this panel 100 times, you know, the best thing, you know, Tego's best asset, the best thing we have is our people. And so to invest in those people and to invest in training classes for them and courses, if they're there and they want to learn how to run a CNC machine, or if they want to learn anything from a business degree to English as a second language to anything, to invest in our workforce and to keep them happy and knowledgeable and at the top of their game, essentially, is the most important thing we can do. So if there's some way to sort of incentivize investment, you know, back into the company and to incentivize ownership, particularly to take profits and things like that, as opposed to just pocketing them, to put them back into the company to help grow it and protect it, I think that's paramount.
Okay, we have a question from Buckley Brinkman. He wants to know, what will be the biggest permanent changes to U.S. manufacturing resulting from COVID-19? You want to jump in?
Yeah, I'll jump in a little bit. It's interesting. I think one of the things that we've been talking about a lot, this experience going through this the last, you know, 4 or 5, 6 months has caused us to really take a look in the mirror at some of the business practices that we have. So one of the things, for example, that we were that we switched to almost overnight, like I mentioned earlier, was work from home for those who could. And that was a change for us because one of the biggest, I would say the biggest benefits to take on, one of the best things about it is our culture. And we, you know, it's something that I think makes people want to stay for a long time. It's got a great supportive environment. You know, switching overnight to really a big portion of the business working from home has changed the way, I think that will change the way we look at, you know, all of a sudden not necessarily having to have employees. If we're hiring somebody for a certain position, if they specialize in that and they don't live in Rhode Island or they don't live in Massachusetts or Connecticut, kind of opening up the, you know, broadening the thought process of, okay, if they live in Wisconsin, that's not a problem. We have the capability, the technology, and being able to think about that. So I think kind of the way that we have looked at that side of it will definitely change moving forward. And John, I don't know if you want to touch on that as well.
So Ben, your answer was awesome, but I have to admit my audio cut out for a second halfway through the question. So I'm not sure exactly what the question was. I apologize.
Yeah. So John, the question was, what's the biggest permanent change to U.S. manufacturing resulting from COVID-19? So, you know, we've talked about kind of operational changes, business practices, and so on. What do you think will be the biggest permanent changes?
So as far as permanent changes, I would say there's probably a couple. I think the biggest one that I don't see going away anytime soon would be the work from home issue that Ben just described. I mean, we found that people can do their job just as well, if sometimes not better, from home. So I don't know that we'll ever go to 100% work from home, but I think going forward, that practice will be probably much more acceptable in companies or more you know, companies will be more open to it in situations where before they may not have been. So I think that's probably one of the largest changes. I think it's also changed, and this is coming from a Takeo perspective, but I think it would apply to other manufacturers, would be it'll change the way we view trade shows and things like that. Because, you know, up until January, we had our largest trade show of the year annually in Orlando, and you have some 50,000 people crammed into one building, and it's a big event. But I just don't know if going forward we're going to look at those events the same. I think people will really have to reevaluate, you know, the importance of trade shows or how they approach them. And that might sound like a small thing, but I mean, in our industry especially, it's a major issue. I think the last thing would be it's probably going to change the way we approach training. For Takeo especially, training is an incredibly important thing. We have a staff of, I want to say, 4 or 5 full-time trainers located all throughout the country who do trainings on-site with different wholesalers and customers and things like that. And they do virtual training as well. We've obviously had to switch to entirely virtual trainings over the last 6 months. And in 6 months, we have between our Takeo Tuesdays, which happen on Tuesdays, Takeo After Dark trainings, which are on Wednesday evenings, and then, you know, different custom trainings for different customers. We've reached out and touched over 14,000 customers, which is for a 6 month period, unheard of. So I think it's going to change the way we do training and perhaps shift from a focus on in-person trainings to a much more broad electronic medium. So once again, that's very, very Takeo specific, but I think that would, in the industry at least, translate fairly across the board.
Susan, what do you think will be the largest permanent changes resulting from COVID for manufacturing?
Well, first of all, shout out to Buckley, who runs really involved in the MEP in Wisconsin, does really great work there. And I think he's going to have his hands full, because I think one of the big changes, I hope, is a renewed appreciation for U.S. manufacturing. I think this renewed appreciation of the importance of risk and hidden costs of the supply chain system that we've developed will lead to that. And so I think then, also, I think maybe a desire to have more robustness, not just in supply chains, but even in the domestic operations. So I was actually thinking when John was talking about training, thinking about training of workforce, that people are now doing jobs that they didn't do before. And, you know, can you actually, in Ohio, there's a company that wants to kind of start off making masks and then, but intentionally invest in equipment that they can make auto parts and then shift over if there's a need for masks. So I think that kind of robustness, you know, and what we need is, you know, financial models that help people understand, you know, how much is that real option valued? So an idea I've had, I guess, is to help with that. I think, you know, we have these Manufacturing USA institutes that are organized around technologies. You know, we have an additive manufacturing one. We have a low power electronics one. What about one for kind of modern management practice? So we could think about, you know, how do you take into account risk in your business? How do you involve your workers and seek input from workers? What kinds of changes in reporting relationships do you need when you put in Industry 4.0? So that, you know, rather than, you know, as a complement to these technically focused Manufacturing USA institutes, have a management focused one that I think could help with, you know, really making some of these lessons long lived.
So, Congressman, we have a question, which I think is appropriate for you from Dankoff. He wants to know, kind of, you know, COVID obviously revealed a lot of problems, a lot of holes in U.S. manufacturing supply chains. He wants to know, how can we make our supply chains more resilient in the future? And if you could unmute.
Sorry about that. Great question. I think actually that's one of the things that I hope is a permanent change, that there is kind of an intentional effort and a kind of deeper understanding of the critical nature of a supply chain, particularly for essential medical supplies in a health pandemic and obviously in a lot of other areas. We actually addressed this issue very specifically in the HEROES Act, in which we included very specific actions to try to protect the supply chain associated with COVID and the pandemic broadly. It provided that the Food and Drug Administration have enforcement authority if a drug maker doesn't provide required notifications on supply chain interruptions or doesn't develop required risk management plans. It permits the FDA to destroy imported counterfeit devices. It authorizes $100 million to designate national centers of excellence in continuous pharmaceutical manufacturing. It directs the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority to award contracts to enhance the manufacturing capacity of a COVID-19 vaccine. And it required the president to appoint a medical supplies response coordinator. So I think the HEROES Act has very specific actions that can be taken to help protect the supply chain. But all the things we've discussed on this panel today about making sure we're protecting manufacturers, make sure we're creating opportunities. If there is a critical product that is not currently available in the United States, what do we need to do to help a manufacturer start that line of manufacturing? Reagents for testing is an example where most of that comes out from outside the United States. So figuring out what is missing in terms of American manufacturing, what do we currently not make? What are the impediments to that? And how do we help facilitate a robust, competitive manufacturing sector on that item as well? So I think, you know, those steps that we included in the HEROES Act, I think, are some important first steps to try to really focus attention on the supply chain. But all the things we've spoken about to encourage and grow American manufacturing obviously are also going to relate to the supply chain.
Okay, great. Thank you. Ben, your thoughts on how to make the supply chain more resilient? And I don't know if you've already made changes in your business practices in that regard.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, John, I think touched on it earlier today, as it pertains to our business, I think one of the crucial things in looking at our supply chain is the forecasting side of things and really being able to look out, you know, a lot of the components that we procure from all over the world have very long lead times. So looking at this, being able to look at dual sourcing and looking at that geographically all over the world, I think also, you know, being able to learning how to build in flexibility, because as things like this situation occur, it's not just thinking about the orders that we will place in the future. It's how it will impact what we are looking at current day and how does that affect our pipeline. So I think looking at our global supply base, and we have a phenomenal team globally working on this side of things, and really rethinking that flexibility side of things, diversifying and dual sourcing, and the importance of the relationships with those suppliers. So in times like these, you're able to work through situations together is going to be, I think, really crucial.
Okay, Susan, I know you've written a lot about supply chain issues. So how do you think we can make them more resilient?
These are a lot of great ideas. I think maybe one overarching thing and one tiny thing. So I think overarching is to think about more supply chain collaboration. And a real example of this is in the 90s, Toyota, had a sole source for a small brake part, and this company had a fire. You think disaster. Well, what happened? There are suppliers from all over the world and all over Japan, even suppliers who made things that were totally different, pitched in to help, get Toyota back on its feet. And so Toyota lost like a day of production due to this massive fire. And so I think that kind of, loyalty, collaboration, communication, and also flexible equipment is really important. And so I think that comes back, and it's different than what's taught in purchasing classes. I used to teach purchasing actually early in my career, and I still teach in a school of management. And so I think one of the things that we need to do as management professors, because I think this is not necessarily something that is a role just for government. You actually offer better shareholder value if your supply chain is more resilient. So I think that's my big message is collaboration and figuring out how to value collaboration, because it's costly. So that's the big thing. And then the smaller thing is I think there's some ways that U.S. government practice, really does encourage offshoring. And just a micro example of this is FDA inspections are much more onerous for U.S. facilities than they are for foreign facilities. For foreign facilities, they are announced in advance and way less detailed and frequent. And so that policy obviously needs to change.
John has a question about the workforce needs, and it's kind of in the context of reshoring jobs, bringing manufacturing jobs back to the United States. And so he wants to know, basically, if we actually do bring jobs back, are we going to have the workforce, and particularly the high-skilled workforce, necessary to actually do the work?
Can I just hop in at kind of a high level on that, if you don't mind, and just say this? I think we will have the workforce, and if the people out there that want to fill those jobs and want to come work in manufacturing don't have those skills immediately, train them. That's the only answer to that. If people want to come and fill those jobs and they're serious about wanting to work in manufacturing so that's the way we look at it at Taco. If you want to come here and work with us, and there's a skill that you need to do that job well, and you're serious about it, and you don't have that skill, we'll do everything we can to train you and give you the tools you need to work for us, to work with us, and to succeed. So maybe that's not the answer that anybody's looking for, but I think if people want to come do the jobs and take it seriously, and they don't have the skills, train them.
Congressman, your thoughts on that? I know you've worked hard on workforce training issues.
Yeah, I think this remains a important challenge. I think we've made significant progress, and I'm particularly proud of the work that's been done in Rhode Island, where our governor really engaged the business community in developing workforce training. It used to be basically workforce training plant programs kind of designed what they imagined people needed, and then they'd train people, and then they'd go look for jobs, which didn't make a lot of sense. What Governor Raimondo has done, which I think is really a national model, is she's brought the employers in and said, what do you actually need in order to hire folks? And then she's trained these people with basically a commitment that once they get that training, they'll have a job. It's called Real Jobs Rhode Island. It's been a fantastic success. So I think what we've learned is when good workforce training programs are designed by paying careful attention to what employers need today and what they'll need tomorrow and in the future, and training is designed to develop those skills, it's critical. And I continue, when I visit manufacturers, I continue to hear, we have vacancies, I just can't find people with these skills. So the ability to hire someone who's willing to learn those skills is critical. So I think this will continue to be an area that the federal government has to play a role in terms of providing resources for good, high-quality job training programs.
Ben, did you have thoughts on the workforce training issue?
I was going to say something very similar to what John said, and also, you know, kind of jumping on also what Congressman Cicilline said. I think the other important part of that as well is, you know, the training is such a big piece of that. And also it's important to train people who are looking for those jobs, but also the continued career path of people internally who are already working within our manufacturing and our company, being able to train them for maybe those positions that they don't have the skills for yet. That will create jobs as well, because as people move up, there will be vacancies that need to be filled. Just that environment of training and making sure that it's training that will help perpetuate a continued career path and growth for employees is going to be extremely important. And anything we can do, as we talked about earlier with some of the investment tax structures and things like that, being able to reinvest and being able to support those training programs. As you know, at TACO, we've always been extremely passionate, starting, you know, my grandfather's starting it, my dad building on it. It tremendously. Training is so important. So whatever we can do to continue to train our workforce, the more the better.
Susan, your thoughts on how we can improve workforce training?
Yeah, no, it's really great to hear the TACO's attitude toward training, and I think, alas, it's rare, and I think it's a potential really great area for a business government collaboration. One area that I think is sometimes missing from these discussions of skill shortage is wages, and that you really want somebody who's going to show up on time and want to embrace learning new things. Well, you know, they need to have money to afford adequate transportation, to feel like their kids are well taken care of, et cetera. And you're also in competition. And so I think, you know, the idea that, you can get a worker with all these skills, and I think TACO is very different, but I've talked to many manufacturers that are kind of mystified about why their workers being paid $10 an hour don't have these skills that they're looking for. The soft skills, they say. And I think it's sort of like, you know, expecting to find a Cadillac or a Lexus for $10,000. You know, are you, do you have a worker shortage or a payment shortage in that case? So I think that the training upgrading and then the wage upgrading also has to have to happen in turn.
So Emily has a question. She wants to know, how can we make it easier for firms to adapt to rapid industry changes? So we know that there is a lot of transformation taking place based on COVID and just the need to protect workers and the need to train them better. But then we also, at the same time, are having changes in business models. There are technological changes that are taking place. We're kind of moving to high-tech, advanced manufacturing. So how can we make it easier for firms to adapt to a world that's changing very rapidly right now?
I would say, you know, the sort of existing competitive model is creating incredible incentives for businesses to figure out how to respond to changes in technology and innovative new materials. And I mean, I think the Biden plan provides for significant investment in research that I think the government can play an important role in facilitating the development of new technologies and new materials. And we're doing that in our infrastructure bill with, you know, kind of new innovative materials in infrastructure. So I think we can do that. But I think part of this is also the way our free enterprise system works, that there's an economic incentive for people to figure it out, to stay competitive and be a successful business. But probably Ben and John have specific ideas on that.
Well, you know, interesting. That's a great point, Congressman. And I think to build on that a little bit, thinking about how do we adapt, I think in certain situations, I don't mean to go this as an example again, but, you know, looking at the work from home structure, that was not something we ever really implemented before this at an extensive level. I think kind of, you know, as my dad says, sometimes unlearning things, right? So we are wired a certain way that this is how we do things and this is how we're going to move forward. I think allowing ourselves the ability to unlearn things because we're wired a certain way, or that we just, that's how it's always been. And looking at ourselves in the mirror a little bit and understanding, you know, in this example, you know, having to do it overnight essentially allowed us to learn that we were able to do it successfully, and also learn what parts of it did work, what parts of it didn't work. And I think part of that structure will work across the board in terms of looking at it from everything from work from home to technology on the floor. There are just certain areas where, as we adapt, it's going to take not only the people who are experts in those areas, but also, and John mentioned this earlier, working with you know, folks who are going to be doing those jobs on the floor and finding what ways work best for, because it's not going to be cookie cutter business to business. It really will be important to learn how different technologies and different business practices work well and efficiently within individual businesses and their different practices.
I guess jump in and say, I think what we need is a mix of kind of competition and collaboration, and that free enterprise works well. But if you compare sort of what a small business like Teco does, has to do in the US with a maybe similar business in Germany, MIT professor Suzanne Berger talks about American firms being kind of home alone. Whereas in contrast, Germany, which is a, you know, very high wage, you know, higher wage country than the US, and yet has almost double the percentage of their GDP from manufacturing. How do they do it? It's because they have the government support for applied R&D and the Fraunhofer Institutes that the Manufacturing USA is modeled after. So there's a support for applied R&D. There's support for long-term finance from kind of government public-private partnerships. There's workforce training that's provided in collaboration with employers, associations, unions, and government. And then there's co-determination for at least the bigger firms to kind of make sure that the business is operated, you know, for a variety of stakeholders, not just shareholders. And so I think these things together really help German small firms, the Mittelstand, the backbone of the German economy. They make them very competitive internationally. And so thinking about how some of those lessons apply to the U.S. economy is something I think that really this pandemic has spurred, and we see it in the plans that the congressman has mentioned and the plans that Biden is proposing.
Nicolina Womack, who works for an organization called Future in Design, wants to know about the cost differentials between moving jobs overseas versus keeping them in the United States. And in particular, wants to know the impact of COVID on that cost differential. Is COVID and other changes that are taking place now going to increase or decrease those cost differentials? And how are you thinking about that in terms of future activities in this area?
I can jump in on that, because I think that's a case where I think companies have actually made some mistakes, that prices in China looked so attractive. Those prices have come up, and then they also are accompanied by some hidden costs that company accounting systems are not well equipped to calculate. So how much does it cost, you know, a miscommunication that leads to the wrong product, or the supplier, you know, substitutes a cheaper material and you weren't there on site to catch it? How do you value all those hidden costs? So there's some work by Harry Moser, the Resoring Institute, that has some calculators that get at some of that stuff. So I think the cost differentials are far smaller than they're often seen to be. And then I think, you know, that what does COVID do? I think there's two possibilities. One is it makes everybody aware of the risk. And so that, you know, when you factor in the risk that you won't get any supply at all, then a local supply looks more attractive. I think on the other hand, you know, because China has done a better job, you know, they had their pandemic early and they've done a better job of curtailing it than we have. Their manufacturers are up and running. They're not incurring, I think, some of the slowdown and reduced capacity that, you know, responsible manufacturers like Tyco are seeing to keep their workers safe. So I think that it's actually a time that policy is super important to take advantage of our realization of risk and make it last long term.
And Congressman, I know you have already talked a little bit about tax incentives that basically encourage companies to offshore. So I'm just wondering, how do you see the impact of COVID on these cost differentials between having jobs abroad versus having them at home? And what can we do to reduce those cost differentials?
I think, you know, a couple of things. One is there's actually a kind of more fundamental question about whether or not you can move certainly workers from the United States to places around the world. There are existing travel restrictions right now. So there's actually just a kind of a logistical question as to whether or not you can actually move an operation if that includes moving personnel, which is a whole separate challenge. But I think, you know, the thing that we have to be concerned about is, you know, companies I think are going to want to ensure that they're keeping their workers safe. And to the extent that there are countries that may, this seems kind of odd coming from the United States because we have failed in very significant ways to follow the science. So it seems a little presumptuous to be saying this, but we certainly want, as a matter of policy, to be sure that we're not allowing American businesses to benefit by sending an operation to a country that maybe doesn't have in place sufficient worker protections, and therefore the cost to that company is less. So we have an additional kind of thing that I think we have to be sensitive to in the middle of a global health pandemic. But I think, you know, again, to resort to the earlier comment, you know, the principal way that I think we have to affect the economics of moving jobs outside of the United States is through our tax code. And we ought to just intentionally design it in a way. If in fact we want to keep and grow manufacturing jobs in the US, then we ought to be willing to use the tax code to create those incentives, or at the very least to remove the opposite incentives that encourage people to move those jobs overseas. Because that's a part of the calculation, is what's the implications for my tax liability as a business. But I think COVID is layering on another challenge that we just have to be very sensitive to, that there isn't some country that maybe has less thoughtful and responsible restrictions on worker safety, and it becomes cheaper to operate there in the middle of a global pandemic. And I just think we have to be very sensitive to that.
Hey, Ben or John, any of your thoughts on jobs in the United States versus jobs abroad? I mean, many of your jobs are located here. You do have a couple of factories abroad as well.
John, you want to take?
Sure. I would say that we do have facilities, manufacturing facilities, several in Europe, also a stainless steel foundry in Vietnam. And they're facilities that we're very, very proud of, and they are both integral parts of our supply chain. But as far as taking jobs that are currently located in the United States and moving them, you know, out of the States offshore somewhere, particularly right now with what's going on, I just don't see that being a viable. I'm speaking probably primarily from a Tyco perspective. I just wouldn't see that being a viable option for several reasons. You know, number one, just the very logistics of being able to, you know, to find another location, travel to and from, the logistics of that piece of it, finding workers to do the job with travel restrictions and what's going on right now. I just don't see that being a particularly easy task. And I could be incorrect, but once again, that's just my kind of take. And I think, you know, once again, from a take perspective, at the very least, you know, we're very, very proud that our primary product lines, you know, are made in America, have always been made in America. And that's part of our brand. It's part of what makes Tyco Tyco. And it's part of what I think creates a lot of trade loyalty, you know, with the heating and cooling contracting trade, and with our OEM customers as well. I mean, we're very, very proud to make our product in America and to support, you know, 500 families here in this country. So I just don't think, any time would be a good time to do that, but especially now when people more than ever, here in America are hurting and need these jobs. And my thought would be absolutely not. So.
Okay. We just have a few minutes left. So I'll ask one final question, which comes from Carol Thomas of NIST, which is the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And this person basically notes that we regularly recognize the power grid, the electrical grid, as a vital and critical infrastructure in the United States, and we devote a lot of efforts to protecting that. Carol notes that we don't bring that same mentality to the manufacturing grid, and basically wants to know if we actually should start to think of the manufacturing grid in a similar way to we think about the power grid as a vital asset and critical infrastructure.
Absolutely. I think we have known for a long time, maybe people haven't articulated it often enough, that having a manufacturing base is essential to our national security, to our ability to protect public health. And we ought to be thinking about the necessity of protecting and promoting and strengthening our manufacturing ecosystem, because it is essential for the survival of our country and of our democracy. And having the privilege of representing the state that was the birthplace of the American Industrial Revolution, I think we can speak with some authority on this. But yes, absolutely. And we ought to treat it that way. And that's why we ought to have a national manufacturing strategy, and why we ought to have policies in place that actually intentionally calibrate where the gaps are and identify the gaps in our manufacturing economy and supply chains that are essential for the defense of our country and the protection of public health and well-being, and make sure we're intentionally investing in filling those gaps. So I think that's a great way to end this panel on a really important point.
Susan, your thoughts on manufacturing as critical infrastructure?
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's a great analogy. It's important to think about building our critical infrastructure in the U.S. And also sort of what is it that we still want to be buying from abroad, that we're not going to be 100% U.S. focused. But I think this metaphor of the grid and the interdependence and the need to, invest up front to prevent calamity later, it's a very helpful reminder. So thank you.
Okay. On that note, we are out of time, but I want to thank Ben, John, Susan, and Congressman Cicilline. Really appreciate sharing your thoughts. COVID certainly has been a big challenge for the manufacturing sector, as well as the country and the world in general. And it will be interesting to see which of the changes, which of the innovations that we've seen so far will turn out to be permanent features of the sector going forward. So to our audience, thank you for tuning in. We appreciate your interest, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah.
Bye, guys.